from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Here's the Minusta soldiers firing from their tank into a residential neighborhood.
Today, an eyewitness account of UN forces in Haiti opening fire in the poor neighborhood outside Cité Soleil as a shocking report in the British medical journal The Lancet on human rights abuses in Haiti finds 8,000 people were murdered and 35,000 women and girls raped during the U.S.-backed coup regime that followed Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And as Haitian death squad leader Emmanuel Constant sits in a New York jail on mortgage fraud charges, we'll speak with a lawyer bringing a lawsuit against him.
I represent three women, all survivors of violence in Haiti, who after waiting 12 years finally got their day in court on Tuesday.
Then Ohioans succeed in delaying the shredding of 2004 Ohio ballots. And an AWOL soldier speaks out before turning himself in Fort Hood, Texas today.
I am not willing to kill or be killed for something I don't believe in. My morals said that going to Iraq was not the right thing to do, and I was not going to live a life of violence. I was not going to participate in war. So I then made the very difficult decision to go AWOL at that point.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The top humanitarian official at the United Nations has lashed out at Israel for unleashing a deluge of cluster bombs in the final hours of its invasion of Lebanon. The official UN Relief Coordinator, Jan Eglin, says the cluster bombs have affected large residential and farming areas and could be on the ground for years.
Colleagues in the UN Mine Action Coordination Center who have undertaken assessments of nearly 85% of bombed areas in South Lebanon. They identified 359 separate cluster bomb strike locations that are contaminated with as many as 100,000 unexploded bomblets. What's shocking, and I would say to me completely immoral, is that 90% of the cluster bomb strikes occurred in the last 72 hours of the conflict, when we knew there would be a resolution, when we really knew there would be an end of this.
The UN's Jan Eglin went on to say some of the cluster bombs came from the United States. He urged the Bush administration to stem further shipments. Eglin also addressed Israel's ongoing siege of the Gaza Strip.
Gaza is a ticking time bomb. You cannot seal off an area which is a little bit bigger than the city of Stockholm, in extension only, have 1.4 million people, of whom 800,000 are youth and children, and then have 200 artillery shells going in there every day, virtually.
Eglin's comments come as Israel says it's completed a six-day incursion into Gaza that killed at least 18 Palestinians. The Israeli army says it uncovered a tunnel that had been dug to launch attacks on its soldiers. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Israeli troops have killed the top commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades during a raid on the city of Nablus. Back in Lebanon, Hezbollah has repeated calls for a negotiated prisoner exchange with Israel. This is Hezbollah member and Lebanese Minister of Water and Energy, Mohamed Finish.
From the beginning, from when the resistance abducted the two Israeli soldiers, the position was clear. The aim of this operation was to negotiate a swap through indirect negotiations. The position was taken before the aggression, and it is only normal that we enforce our position in that there is no unconditional release, and it can only be achieved through a swap and indirect negotiations.
Israel has publicly dismissed calls for a prisoner swap. Meanwhile, the Israeli government has rejected UN Secretary General Kofi Annan's call for an end to its air and sea blockade of Lebanon. Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says the blockade will continue until his government determines Lebanon has complied with the UN ceasefire resolution. Kofi Annan was in the West Bank Wednesday for meetings with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas at a joint news conference. Annan said ending Israel's occupation of Palestinian land is the key to peace in the Middle East.
The suffering of the Palestinian people must not be forgotten
as we strive to bring peace to Lebanon. President Abbas and I fully agreed that an end to the occupation and the creation of a Palestinian state living side by side with Israel is the key to resolving the problems of this troubled region.
Annan also said the Arab League is preparing to revive the four-year-old Beirut initiative that offers Israel a comprehensive peace agreement in return for its full withdrawal from territories occupied in the 1967 war. Annan says the offer will be discussed at a meeting of Arab foreign ministers in Cairo next week. Israel's foreign minister, Tzipi Livni, says Israel will oppose the effort because it prefers to reach separate agreements with individual countries. In Lebanon, Prime Minister Fuad Senyora said Wednesday his government will no longer deal with Israel directly and would be the last to sign a peace deal with it because of the recent invasion. Senyora also announced his government will pay $33,000 to Lebanese whose homes were destroyed by Israeli attacks. Senyora says some 130,000 housing units were damaged or destroyed in the 34-day war. The State Department announced Wednesday U.S. assistance could start reaching Lebanon by next week. The delivery had been put into question after a high-ranking Congress member announced this week he would ask the Bush administration to freeze its aid package to Lebanon. The Congress member, California Democrat Tom Lantos, said the freeze would last until the Lebanese government takes control of its borders and, quote, displays responsibility. At a news conference in the United Arab Emirates, U.S. Ambassador Michelle Sisson was asked how the U.S. could reconcile sending aid to Lebanon after giving Israel most of the weaponry that attacked the country.
I want to make very clear that, of course, America is making and has made a long-term commitment to help the people of Lebanon. We believe that every person deserves to live in a free and open society. And, of course, we have stated throughout, and particularly during the period of the crisis, that we reject the killing of innocents to achieve a radical and violent agenda. And I'm looking at Hezbollah as I speak to this.
The administration's $230 million for Lebanon has been criticized for being at least one-tenth of annual U.S. military aid to Israel. But there are reports that the disparity could get even wider. A high-ranking American diplomat tells the Jerusalem Post the Bush administration would seriously consider an Israeli request for more money to make up for the large expense of its attack on Lebanon. Israel says it spent close to $7 billion and may ask the U.S. for up to $2 billion. Critics say an aid increase would bolster speculation the U.S. had a role in encouraging Israel's attack on Lebanon. Earlier this month, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh reported the U.S. helped plan the Lebanon war in part to remove Hezbollah as a deterrent to a potential bombing of Iran. In his interview with the Jerusalem Post, the U.S. diplomat denied Hersh's report, but admitted the administration was not surprised by Israel's decision to attack. In other news, The Washington Times is reporting the Pentagon is drafting war plans under the assumption Iran is 5 to 8 years away from being able to build its first nuclear weapon. Defense sources say the time frame gives the Bush administration additional leeway to decide on whether to launch military strikes. Iran faces a U.N. Security Council deadline today to stop enriching uranium. At the U.N. Wednesday, U.S. Ambassador John Bolton warned the U.S. will seek sanctions if Iran fails to comply.
In terms of Iran, we've said repeatedly that we expect that no later than August the 31st, pursuant to Security Council Resolution 1696, that the Iranians will suspend all uranium enrichment-related activity. Now, if they haven't done that by August the 31st, we've also said repeatedly, and the foreign ministers of the five permanent members of the Security Council in Germany have agreed, that we will come to the Security Council to seek sanctions.
The New York Times is reporting the push for sanctions may be hampered by a new report today from the International Atomic Energy Agency. The report says Tehran has made only slow progress in uranium enrichment and doesn't have the capability to produce uranium for nuclear weapons. Iran continues to insist its nuclear program is peaceful and should be dealt with as part of comprehensive negotiations. Iran's deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, spoke earlier today on a visit to Japan.
And we are confident about the peaceful nature of our program. So if there is also goodwill and sincerity in the other side, we are sure that we can reach a good solution, a good conclusion through negotiations, and we hope that we can start negotiations as soon as possible.
That was Iran's foreign deputy minister. In Sri Lanka, international truce monitors are accusing government forces of being behind this month's massacre of 17 local aid workers. The workers were all employees of the French group Action Against Hunger. This is International Monitor Major General Ulf Henriksen.
That's one of the reasons we have ruled this against the government, that we have strong indication that it was done by a group or individuals linked to the security forces. And when it happened, it was very clear in the government statement that they controlled Mutter, even if they deny it today.
The Sri Lankan government angrily rejects the charges and says it's carrying out its own investigation. In Chile, President Michelle Bachelet declared a new National Day Wednesday to honor the thousands killed during Chile's 17-year dictatorship. Bachelet made the announcement from the site of the U.S.-backed coup that overthrew President Salvador Allende.
I establish August 30th as the National Day of the Disappeared, and I do it with all the solemnity that this official declaration can have, but at the same time with all the symbolism carried by the fact that it was exactly here in La Moneda Palace where the first disappearances occurred on September 11th, 1973.
Scores of relatives of the disappeared attended the ceremony. Bachelet herself is a former political prisoner, as was her mother. Her father, a general, was imprisoned and then died. In Darfur, the International Committee of the Red Cross has announced the killing of one of its aid workers. The Red Cross did not release his name. The worker was kidnapped there 2 weeks ago. Meanwhile, the Sudanese government has charged a visiting American journalist with espionage. Paul Salopek, who won two Pulitzer Prizes as foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, was arrested 3 weeks ago in Darfur. He's in the region on a freelance assignment for National Geographic magazine. He faces several years in prison. In a statement, Chicago Tribune editor and senior vice president Anne-Marie Lipinski said, Salopek is one of the most accomplished and admired journalists of our time. We're deeply worried about Paul and his well-being and appeal to the government of Sudan to return him safely home. Here in the United States, the state of California has announced a landmark deal that will impose this country's first broad limits on emissions of greenhouse gases. The measure would target power plants, oil refineries, and cement factories to reduce California's emissions by one quarter over the next 14 years. Democratic lawmakers and Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger struck the deal over the objections of the Bush administration and local business leaders. California currently accounts for 2% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. President Bush is in Utah today, where he's expected to launch a new public relations blitz in defense of the Iraq War. The Washington Post reports the president's speech will be the first of many, accusing Democrats of aiming to appease terrorists and cut off funding for troops on the battlefield. Under questioning from reporters, White House officials were unable to cite one major Democrat who's proposed cutting off funds to U.S. troops. On Wednesday, President Bush insisted his new speeches are not political, saying, quote, I seriously hope people wouldn't politicize these issues that I'm going to talk about. His comments come one day after Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld likened critics of the war in Iraq to those who tried to appease Nazi Germany during the 1930s. He was speaking to the American Legion in Salt Lake City, the same group the president will address today. And as President Bush begins his PR effort, the Washington Post is reporting the Pentagon has tendered a new $20 million contract to promote more, quote, positive news coverage of the Iraq War. The contract calls on bidders to monitor and analyze news coverage in the U.S. and international media. The stories would be analyzed for their tone and attitude towards U.S. military operations and used as part of a program to provide public relations products that would improve coverage of the military. A public relations industry source said the Pentagon has been overwhelmed by news stories that have differed from how the military originally wanted them transmitted. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and to our growing audience around the world. In Haiti, human rights abuses have been widespread and systematic following the ouster of democratically elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in February 2004. Now a new report is claiming that during the 22-month period of the U.S.-backed interim government, 8,000 people were murdered in the greater Port-au-Prince area alone. 35,000 women and girls were raped or sexually assaulted, more than half of the victims being children. Kidnappings, extrajudicial detentions, physical assaults, death threats, and threats of sexual violence were also common. Those responsible for the human rights abuses include criminals, the police, United Nations peacekeepers, and anti-Lavalas gangs.
The findings are based on a new report published in the British medical journal The Lancet. The study's based on an extensive survey of households in the Port-au-Prince area of Haiti. Athena Colby is one of the authors of the report. She's a master's-level social worker with the Wayne State University School of Social Work in Detroit, Michigan. She joins us from a studio in San Francisco. We're also joined by Dr. Royce Hudson on the phone from Detroit, co-author of the report, assistant professor of social work at Wayne State University. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Athena Colby, these are startling findings. 8,000 murdered over what time period? And how do you know this?
Basically what we did is we randomly selected households in the greater Port-au-Prince area, 1,260 households, and then went and interviewed them about their experiences with human rights violations beginning in February 29th, 2004, with the departure of Aristide, through December of 2005, which is the one-month period where we did the interviews. So based on that, we found that 23 households out of the 1,260 had members who had been assassinated in that time period. And the figure of 8,000 is derived from, estimating that based on the population of the greater Port-au-Prince area.
Now, when you say randomly selected, obviously in Haiti, one of the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, a lot of people don't have phones or locating folks. Could you explain your use of GPS to actually develop who would be the random household selected?
Well, this is actually kind of a unique type of a study because this methodology hasn't really been used before in public health and human rights studies. It was used a little bit in the another Lancet study about Iraq deaths before and after the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But what we did is we randomly selected GPS locations, 1,500 of them, and then went and visited each location, eliminated the ones that weren't actually households, the ones that were, you know, the side of a mountain or the airport runway or whatever, and then went and interviewed people at the remaining ones that were households. And we had an over 90% response rate, which is extraordinarily high. It really indicates that even those that that were legitimate sites where we went and talked to people, most people were willing to talk to us, indicating that, you know, they had something to say and wanted their story to be told about their experiences with human rights.
And can you talk about who carried out these killings?
We had the largest number of perpetrators for most of the violations were criminals, indicating that there was high rates of criminal activity, but also we also had a number of assassinations that were done by members of the Haitian National Police, as well as killings by UN soldiers and killings by demobilized soldiers from the ex-Haitian army that was disbanded by President Aristide in 1995.
And in terms of the rapes and sexual assaults, because you said that you identified actually 23 families that had actually experienced assassinations or killings within their own families. And in terms of the raw numbers on the actual rapes and assaults, and then how you extrapolated those to this astounding number of 35,000.
Dr. Hudson could actually talk a little bit more about that because he has the figures right in front of him. But I believe that it was 93 families total out of the 1,260 that had sexual assault victims in their household. And some of those had multiple victims within one household.
Dr. Royce Hudson, could you follow up on that?
Sure, absolutely. Actually, Athena, it was 94, but yeah, very close. So we took 94 and we essentially extrapolated it to the greater Port-au-Prince area with the estimated number of females in the greater Port-au-Prince area that we got from our own sample. A census data wasn't really available with regards to you know, what's the average household size, how many, what percentage of the population is female. So we had to sort of construct those figures for ourselves, and then we took those constructed figures and then extrapolated our findings to the greater Port-au-Prince area, and we got to 35,000, roughly, female sexual assault victims.
We're going to break, and then we're going to come back to this discussion and also go to Haiti. Videotape that is quite shocking of UN forces moving into the neighborhood around Cité Soleil and opening fire. We're also going to talk with an attorney who is brought a lawsuit against a man who now sits in a New York jail. He's sitting there for mortgage fraud charges, but he's a leader of a paramilitary death squad, Emmanuel Constant. And they have brought a lawsuit against him for sexual abuse and rape of women in Haiti. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On the phone with us, Athena Colby, social worker with the Wayne State University School of Social Work in Detroit. We're also joined on the telephone by Dr. Royce Hudson, assistant professor of social work at Wayne State. Athena is in a San Francisco TV studio. Athena, Juan, a question.
Yes, I'd like to ask Dr. Hudson. These findings are so startling that obviously a lot of people are going to question them because this is something that really has not been extensively reported in the past. So I'd like to ask you, some of the in your figures, you claim that over 50% of the murders were committed by government forces or anti-Lava Las groups, and the bulk of the others by criminals, very few by Lava Las supporters themselves, and also in the rapes, about a quarter of them were committed by either government forces, police, or anti-Lava Las groups. Now, obviously, this is a peer-reviewed study appearing in The Lancet, but your defense of those who will say that you're basically extrapolating from very small numbers of people that you actually interviewed who were victims of these crimes.
Well, actually, it wasn't. I would argue that it was not really that small of a number, though it was 1,260 households that really represented 5,720 individuals. And in survey methodology, that's considered a rather large number of people to be surveying. If you looked at our, for instance, if you looked at our confidence intervals, you'll find that for at least the number of and extrapolated figures, I should explain that those are pretty tight figures. Because our ends are pretty, our sample sizes are rather large. With regards to who is committing these, we made a special point of, for instance, not using interviewers that are associated with Lava Las or Les Poix political parties, in the interest of trying to keep this study nonpartisan. Of course, there's the possibility that people would claim that someone did something to them when they didn't. But we find that that, in fact, probably was not the case, and that when we look at the figures, it goes across the breadth of various anti-Lavalas groups, the Demobilized Army, the HNP, which are not exactly what I would consider to be a sole entity. They are, in fact, separate groups.
And just to explain, Lavalas being pro-Aristide forces, Aristide removed in Haiti in 2004 and a U.S.-backed coup against him. We're talking about this period after his removal.
That's correct. We didn't detect any Lavalas atrocities with regards to murder, sexual assault. We did detect some physical assaults by Lavalas members and some threatening behavior by Lavalas members. So they're not completely exonerated from any human rights abuses. However, as the questioner noted, a vast majority of the atrocities that weren't committed by criminals but by others were from groups affiliated in some fashion with anti-Lavalas movements.
Athena Colby, who are the Restiveks?
The Restiveks are unpaid domestic servants. They're children, usually from the countryside, who come into the city and they work with Haitian households in exchange for room and board. And we found that girls who were Restiveks were particularly at risk for sexual assault, more so than other children, although children in general were particularly at risk, but also more so than even adult women. And this really begs the question of, when you have so many Restiveks who were sexually assaulted, and when we're talking about sexual assault, also, I want to clarify, we're not just talking about molestation or someone grabbing someone sexually when they don't want it. We're talking about more than 90% of the sexual assaults in our study were involved penetration. And some of them involved multiple perpetrators, involved penetration with inanimate objects, like a piece of metal. These were very brutal sexual assaults that we recorded. And when we're looking at such high numbers of children being sexually assaulted by officers from the Haitian National Police, and in particularly this vulnerable group of child domestic servants, it really makes you wonder what exactly was going on under the interim Haitian government in regards to the sexual assault of children by police officers.
And what about the international peace monitoring force that is stationed there? Did you find any indication of violations, human rights violations by them?
We certainly did, although the rates were lower than some people might have expected. We found that they had very high rates of threatening behavior, of committing death threats, threats of sexual and physical violence. And by threats, we mean not just pointing your gun at someone, because when you're a peacekeeping soldier, you know, you carry a gun. If you have to point it at people, then some people might interpret that as a threat. We didn't count that as a threat. We counted threats as something verbal, do this or I'll kill you, where the person really felt like they were legitimately threatened, like their life was really at stake, or the life of their family was really at stake. And they had a very, actually relatively high numbers of death threats and threats of sexual and physical violence, which is perhaps indicative of a pattern of perhaps a lack of training, or since it was so many troops from different countries as well who are involved in this threatening behavior, that perhaps the United Nations forces are not interacting with the Haitian populace in a really appropriate way.
I want to stay on this issue of UN forces. Is life improving under the new presidency of René Préval? Just last week, UN forces opened fire on a poor neighborhood outside Cité Soleil. An international delegation was in the area and witnessed what happened. They also caught some of the raid on tape. In a moment, we'll play a clip of that tape. But first, we're joined in our Firehouse studio by one of the witnesses, Ben Terrell, who is a writer and activist just returned from this delegation in Haiti. Ben, would you set the scene for us about what we're going to see?
Well, I was with other members of this delegation on a road in Simon Pelé, which is adjacent to Cité Soleil. It joins it on one side. And we saw two armored personnel carriers come in as we were there and go down one street, and on a perpendicular street there were two other APCs. And I personally saw five or six Brazilian UN troops run out of one of the APCs into the neighborhood, and we went towards the APC and we got footage.
This footage is quite something. Let's go to the day of the UN raid in Simon Pelé. These are members of the international delegation describing the scene.
We're in Pelé in Cité Soleil, and we just heard several rounds of gunfire. We saw soldiers jump out of the tank and run into the houses nearby. Sounds like they were shooting from inside the houses.
Last week, there were several groups in Cité Soleil who said they would turn over their weapons. But since MINUSTAH has continued to shoot on the population, they have not done that. As you can see right here, they are continuing to shoot on the population.
Here's the MINUSTAH soldiers firing from their tank into a residential neighborhood. And the blue helmets signify that it's UN soldiers. And they're wearing the Brazilian uniforms. They're getting instructions over the radio right now. They don't seem to be at all deterred by our presence. More troops have moved into position here, and it looks like a military operation underway. The foot troops are going to the area, the infantry troops are going into the area. They're positioning themselves for some kind of an attack in this civilian neighborhood.
This is the same formula they used when they killed Dred Wilme on the 6th of July last year. So they are cutting off a street here using bulldozers so people can't get in and out. They say they are looking for bandits, but we do not know exactly who they are looking for.
19-year-old Wildert Samedi was shot and killed by the UN troops in the raid. The delegation caught up with his mother, Adasia Samedi, 4 days after the shooting. She talked about her son.
After I lost my son, I didn't even know what to do. I couldn't even stand up. I felt like I lost him in a very bad situation. My message to the UN is to thank them for the son that they killed. They are always looking for bandits. Apparently, they didn't get them. At this time, any innocent civilians just passing can get shot for nothing.
Ben Terrell, there is a grieving mother. Explain what she's saying, because maybe it misses something in translation as she says, I thank the UN troops.
Well, I was going to ask her if she had a message to the outside world, but we just sort of let her talk about the experience, and she described how her son was fixing the radio on the roof as the snipers came in, and she said, this is my message to the UN. I want to thank you for killing my son. You come in here. I don't know why you're here. Civilians are killed all the time. So this is part of a pattern. This operation.
She's being sarcastic.
Completely sarcastic. Yes, she's very, obviously very bitter about this. And her son did nothing to deserve this. He wasn't connected to an armed group. He was just fixing a radio on the roof. And this has been true throughout these operations. I talked to an older man who is leaving the neighborhood who said there have been many people killed. We have him on tape as we were interviewing him. He said many people had been killed and they weren't connected to armed groups. So the UN, the UN is operating without oversight. They're operating with impunity. They're going in and they're just quote unquote securing these neighborhoods at the behest of the ultra right wing small elite in Haiti that want to kill as many people as possible in these areas. They're not going after death squads. They're not disarming the rightist backed forces and the holdover forces from the coup, which unfortunately are still controlling the judiciary. They're controlling much of the Haitian government. And though there have been a small number of high-profile political prisoners released, as well, they've been targeting people. So this week I spoke with an incredible Lavalas organizer who's very close to Aristide, who'd been with Lavalas from the early years. And he come back from exile. His name is René Seville. He come back from exile, and he was picked up for what looks to be a completely bogus charge. His lawyer has denounced the charges on the radio, and I spoke to him, and it just looked completely ridiculous. He left his car in Haiti. He went to the DR. They're charging him with crimes committed by the police when they had his car when he was in exile. So this guy spoke to us earlier in the week about a program he was running, which was getting scholarships to poor kids. He's working with the poorest of the poor, as the Lavalas movement is all about. I mean, their motto was from misery to poverty with dignity. And apparently the U.S. continues to just feel, oh, clearly the U.S., France, and Canada continues to not be willing to accept that. And their friends who are still in power there just want to target these people as much as possible and kill people and do all the things that we heard of in the Lancet reports.
I'd like to ask you about some of these incidents and the atrocities of the UN peacekeepers. What kind of coverage in the media, first of all, in Haiti, because the rest of the world has already forgotten Haiti ever since the Préval came back, was reelected as president. But in terms of what's happened now in terms of the Haitian media?
Well, the largely right-wing elite-controlled Haitian media is driven by these ultra-rich, ultra-right forces that want the UN to crack down further. They want them to kill more people. There's been a campaign of complete dehumanization of the poorest neighborhoods in Haiti. And so you're not getting accurate information in most of the Haitian press, and it's a small number of radio stations. But certainly internationally, we never hear the broader context of what the UN has been doing since the beginning of the coup, which is backing up the Haitian police, aiding and abetting slaughters. And this went on in the first 2 years. A key factor of this is this went on in the first 2 years, and they were provoking the population by engaging in vast numbers of killings, the police. It's been thoroughly documented before the Lancet study by the University of Miami Law School, by filmmaker Kevin Pina, by the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. So they kill off, they imprison, they torture the nonviolent leadership. And then a small number of people, after 2 years of these attacks, take up arms, but they're very limited in number, and it's something that I think people in Houston would do if their neighborhoods were under siege by armed forces for 2 years. And you have to remember, in the 91 coup, there are like 5,000 people killed, so people have this memory of that, and it's always in the media reporting, it's always taken out of that context. And also, you never hear about the people that are running free, you know, the right-wing people like Guy Philippe, who is a key player in the coup forces that came in from the north, who is trained by the U.S., you know, and Jodel Chamblain is out now, too. And these people are running around. They're old Duvalier people running around who are backing all these death squads, and nobody's disarming them.
Well, I want to talk about some of these people, actually one in particular, and he's not running around Haiti. He's here in the United States. Right here in this country, two women have testified at an evidentiary hearing in a case against the former Haitian death squad leader living in New York City. The suit against Emmanuel Toto Constant was launched in December 2004 by a group of women who suffered gang rape and other abuses from Constant's forces. Constant led the paramilitary group called FRAP. It's an acronym for Front for the Advancement and Progress of Haiti, which killed thousands of supporters and the former Haitian president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Constant's been allowed to live freely in the U.S. after threatening to reveal the full extent of his ties to the CIA. The U.S. government ignored several requests for his extradition. Constant was arrested in a separate case last month, not for human rights abuses, but for committing mortgage fraud. Moira Feeney joins us in the studio. She's usually in San Francisco, but she is the lead lawyer in the civil case against Constant, so she came to New York. She's also staff attorney with the Center for Justice and Accountability. Tell us why you're here.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm here because on Tuesday we had a hearing in New York, in the Southern District of New York, in front of federal judge Stein, who listened to testimony. We brought testimony from five different witnesses, two of our clients who actually took the stand. They had to actually sit behind a screen so that their identities could be protected. But they were able to speak in open court and give their stories of survival. And both of these women were victims of a gang rape that occurred in 1994 at the hands of members of FRAP. And FRAP, the important thing to know about the word FRAP, in Creole means a strong blow. and FRAP was led by Toto Constant. Now, in addition to these women, we had three experts, one expert on the history of Haiti, gave the political context of the rise of FRAP and Constant's role as the commander of this paramilitary organization. And after that, we heard from a medical expert about the specific trauma that our client suffered, and finally, a psychologist who spoke specifically about the trauma, psychological trauma, that our clients have endured as a result of politically motivated gang rape, that 12 years later, they're still very much living with the reality that they suffered at the time in Haiti. They live with that every single day.
And what was the defense mounted by Toto Constant?
Constant never answered our suit. We served him with the papers on the streets of Manhattan on January 14th of 2005. He then did not reply to the suit. And this is a civil suit for human rights abuses under the Alien Tort Statute and the Torture Victim Protection Act. So he did not answer the suit, which, you know, the 90 days that he had to answer passed. We went to the judge and requested a default judgment against him. And on August 16th, just of this year, the judge issued that default against him. He did not appear in court. He is sitting in Suffolk County Jail on Long Island.
Explain why.
In July, he was arrested after a quite thorough investigation by the Attorney General's Office of New York for his involvement in a mortgage fraud scheme. And he has been charged with several counts, criminal counts, that include falsifying business documents and fraud. And these are felony charges. And he's awaiting trial now, which will likely happen in the next several months. The judge said, a $50,000 cash bail. He has not posted bail, and he remains in jail.
That's a little surprising, given the support that Constant has had from the U.S. government. He was a CIA employee for a while, that he hasn't been able to post $50,000 in bail to get out of jail. Is that?
Well, I'm speculating, but my guess is that he's not posting bail, not for lack of funds, potentially, but because the immigration authorities have put a hold on him. And what that means is that if he were to leave Suffolk County Jail, they could pick him up and put him in immigration holding. But any time that he spends in immigration holding would not count as time served if and when he was convicted in the criminal case.
And on that issue of immigration holding, could he be deported to Haiti? And if he were, what would happen?
Well, that's a good question, and it's hard to answer at this point. I think that what we know is that there is a standing deportation order against him. That order has been in place since 1995. He was ordered deported in 1995. He was, in fact, in immigration detention at the time. But he began giving interviews about his relationship with the U.S. government, specifically the CIA, and he was released from detention, and he's been allowed to stay in the U.S., although he was checking in with immigration authorities on a weekly basis. But the deportation order still stands. So why that deportation order hasn't been acted on so far, according to most news sources, is because the State Department has said that there was no guarantee that in Haiti he would be given a fair trial. So it's yet to be seen whether or not the State Department will intervene if and when the immigration authorities here in the U.S. actually move to deport him.
And what happens now with the default judgment that you've been able to get? What's the next step in your case?
Well, the next step is, now that we've had a chance to give testimony and this opportunity for the women to present their story and to really let the judge understand the extent of the widespread and systematic campaign of sexual violence that was engineered by Constant and his men in FRAP, the judge now will take that information, and hopefully he will award a generous damages amount for both compensatory and punitive damages, is what we've requested. So we're awaiting his decision on that, and then what that means is that we have already now a judgment against him, and then we will simply then have an actual amount to attach to that judgment.
Finally, you said the women testified before a screen. We only have a minute, but how was it for them to speak about their experience?
It was powerful.
Their faces were hidden.
Their faces were hidden, but their voices were strong. It was very emotional. There were tears, but there was also a lot of joy at the end of the testimony because they expressed an extreme satisfaction that finally, after all of these years, they had a chance to sit before a judge and tell their story. And they said, this has been 12 years that they've been waiting to do this and fighting for this day, and they finally made it.
And this was Jane Doe number one, Jane Doe number two, and there was another woman, Jane Doe number three, afraid of being identified.
That's right.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Moira Feeney with the Center for Justice and Accountability, lead attorney in the case against Emmanuel Constant, will continue to follow his case. And we'll also link on our website to Alan Nairn's pieces from over a decade ago in The Nation magazine, who exposed the CIA ties of Emmanuel Constant. This was during the coup that ousted Jean-Bertrand Aristide the first time. Also, Ben Terrell, thank you for being with us. Activists from the West Coast just returned from Haiti. We, on our website, will post the video footage. People can watch that footage, startling footage of UN forces moving in to poor neighborhood outside Cité Soleil and opening fire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Athena Colby and Dr. Hudson, thank you so much for being with us. We will link to the Lancet piece, the medical journal piece, that says they found over the last few years during the U.S.-backed coup regime, 8,000 people were murdered in Haiti, 35,000 women and girls raped or sexually abused. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to Ohio. A public outcry has forced the state to delay its plans to destroy the ballots from the contested 2004 presidential elections. Allegations of fraud and disenfranchisement in the state continue to cause people to question the results, which declared Bush the winner by a 130,000 vote margin. Just yesterday, Senator John Kerry, who lost to Bush, sent an email to Democratic supporters. He stated that the Secretary of State of Ohio, Kenneth Blackwell, used his office to, quote, suppress the Democratic vote.
A lawsuit was expected to be filed in federal court today that seeks to preserve the ballot so that voting problems in the election can be fully investigated and understood. We turn now to Stephen Rosenfeld, co-author of the forthcoming book, What Happened in Ohio, a documentary record of theft and fraud in the 2004 elections. Can you explain what's happening? Will a lawsuit be filed, or will the announcement by the state of Ohio that they won't destroy the ballots preempt the lawsuit?
A lawsuit will be filed, and the lawsuit will say that voters in Ohio in 2004 were deprived of equal treatment, which is a civil rights claim. And it's actually pretty easy to prove that that was the case, because we can show that there were long lines in many urban cities. We can show that there were voter purges that actually targeted cities where there were where African Americans were the vast majority of the population. And there are many things like that. And the relief that, well, What we were initially seeking was, as we filed that suit, was to preserve the evidence of the 2004 election, which is the actual ballots and voter sign-in books and things that, it's really the paper trail that says which votes were counted, which votes were not counted, were they counted accurately, and so forth.
And do you see this, the state's actions announced yesterday as an attempt to head off your lawsuit?
Well, clearly, yes. It was absolutely prompted by it. You know, the rule is that federal ballots must be held for 22 months. Now, 22 months is the 22-month anniversary of the 2004 election is September 2nd. So, absolutely, under a threat of this civil rights suit and questioning by some major media that was covering this, the Secretary of State announced that he would issue an order. It would actually create a process by which ballots could be destroyed, but the immediate effect is to postpone that for a couple of months. So actually, that enables us and other people who are investigating what happened to keep looking at these ballots, and it should be it's to be contrasted with Florida, where in 2003 the Secretary of State ordered that all of their 2,000 ballots be sent to the state archive. So you can see the difference.
And talk about Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State of Ohio. What role has he played in this?
Well, Ken Blackwell is now running for governor. It's a very partisan campaign, but he has been perhaps the most heavy-handed Secretary of State or election administrator in recent U.S. history. We would say, those of us who have investigated what happened in Ohio, more so than Catherine Harris in Florida. What happened in Ohio was that the Republicans at basically every level of their political organizations targeted the voting process to create all kinds of obstacles that ended up disenfranchising literally tens of thousands of people in cities across the country, across the state. And then, you could see the evidence for that is really clear. It was the long lines, it was the voter purges, it was all the disqualified ballots, it was all kinds of rules for which ballots would be counted. You know, it was voters who were challenged with their registrations when they walked into polls. The other half of that is that it looks like in the Republican areas that were very strong, all those standards were not applied evenly, and it looks like to us that the vote counting was... We think we found what looks like ballot box stuffing. And when we say that, what we mean is we actually have gone in to count the paper records, and we say here several hundred voters signed in to vote, but when you look at the official results, there are 100 more or 150 more precinct by precinct. So all of this happened under a Secretary of State who created an atmosphere that was very permissive that allowed this to happen. And he set the tone because he basically created all these rules that would say which voters would be allowed to vote, which ballots would be qualified, disqualified, et cetera. And that's the way he has run the state. And he's done this with this incredibly sanctimonious personality and air that he's, Mr. Election Integrity.
Stephen Rosenfeld, Phil, we're going to have to leave it there. But I want to thank you very much for being with us, co-author of the forthcoming book, What Happened in Ohio, a documentary record of theft and fraud in the 2004 election. Juan?
Well, we end today by hearing from a soldier who refuses to fight in Iraq. The Pentagon estimates that an estimated 8,000 members of the U.S. military have gone AWOL since the start of the Iraq War. Democracy Now! Recently interviewed one of them, Sergeant Ricky Clousing, who was AWOL for more than a year. We talked to him on the day he turned himself in at Fort Lewis in Washington State. Well, today we bring you another soldier, Mark Wilkerson, who also has been AWOL for more than a year. He's turning himself in at Fort Hood in Texas today. Mark taped this video statement on Tuesday.
My name is Mark Wilkerson. I'm 22 years old. I'm a native of Colorado Springs, Colorado. My experience in the military began from birth, basically, because my dad was in the military. My grandpa was in the military. My grandma was in the Marines. So it was basically just an understanding, an oral understanding from an early age that the military was the path I was going to take. So I enlisted my junior year of high school. That was before September 11th. And then after September 11th happened, my resolve became more solid. I felt that by joining the military through my experience, I would somehow be avenging the deaths of those people who died on that day. Well, I went to basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And after I graduated from there, I ended up at Fort Hood, Texas. I was a military policeman, so I was attached to the 720th Military Police Battalion. And in March 2003, we ended up deploying to Iraq. Well, I was very optimistic about going to Iraq. I supported the president's decision to go in then, and I felt we would be doing really good things for the people of Iraq. Then I went in, and based on the experiences I had, I just came away with a completely different experience than the one I had. It was like a complete life turnaround for me. I viewed spirituality different, religion, I viewed human relationships different, and I viewed our government different. I was told that we'd be winning the hearts and minds of the people. That was the key to winning the war on terrorism, was winning the hearts and minds of the people who we would be dealing with in Iraq. And when I went there, I started to see that that wasn't going to happen at all. A lot of times, we would do random raids on homes because our NCOs or our officers would get bored. So they'd order us to raid a whole group of homes. And a lot of times, if the men inside the house, if there was something as little as a knife or a gun, we would haul all the men away. At that point, there was no paperwork done on a lot of these prisoners. So for all I know, some of these people could still be in prison. And the daughters and some of the younger boys and stuff saw their husbands, their fathers, their grandpas, their brothers and sisters, their brothers, you know, they saw them being dragged away. They don't know where to. They didn't know what was going to happen to them. So that's creating an anger there. And then we would delay many of the Iraqis' daily lives. We would interrupt their daily lives because we would do checkpoints where we'd search the vehicles and we would search them. And a lot of times this would back traffic up for hours. At the gas stations, we were monitoring the vehicles coming in and out of there, and that would delay the vehicles for several hours. So we were disrupting their daily lives, driving up and down these streets, making them very angry at us. So I can understand when they feel that we're invaders who've overstayed their welcome, and they're going to fight back. Based on the experiences I had in Iraq, I came back, and I saw how much money was being made by members of our government, and I saw how much money was being made by these massive corporations. So I started to put some things together that I had come to know as true. So based on what I learned, I decided that the military and me were no longer one, that I had to separate myself from the military. So I wanted to do it the right and legal way. So I applied for conscientious objector in March 2004, right after I got back from Iraq. So that process started in March, and it ended November with the military saying, no, you don't meet the requirements for a conscientious objector. Now, while that was going on, in July of that year, we found out we would be returning to Iraq in January 2005. So after my conscientious objector claim got denied in November, we filed for a rebuttal. But we were told that this rebuttal, which basically what a rebuttal is it's something that we write up and we counterpoint every point that they make as to why I don't meet the requirements, and we argue why I do. I felt it was a very good rebuttal, but the military said that they weren't going to even review it until I deployed to Iraq again and came back. So I was not willing to wait that long. I am not willing to kill. I'm not willing to be killed. I am not willing to kill or be killed for something I don't believe in. My morals said that going to Iraq was not the right thing to do, and I was not going to live a life of violence. I was not going to participate in war. So I then made the very difficult decision to go AWOL at that point.
Mark Wilkerson speaking from Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. He turns himself in today at Fort Hood, Texas. Special thanks to Patrick Phillips of New Spark Media, and that does it for our broadcast. You can watch that videotape on our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Abdul Kadush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, and Jen Utes. Nick Marsilio, our engineer. We begin our Break the Sound Barrier tour this weekend, going to Provincetown, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket. Next week, we'll be in Milwaukee and Baraboo, Minneapolis, and in New York on September 11th. With Juan Gonzalez, I'll be joined by jazz legend Charlie Hayden, singer Dar Williams, also performances from Sarah Jones and others. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.